Welcome to Weekly Leader Podcast, episode number 8 for June 10th, 2009. I'm Peter Mello from Sea Fever Consulting and the founder and editor of Weekly Leader, the blog and the podcast. And my podcasting partner and fellow blogger is Pam Fox Rollin from Idea Shape. Hi, Pam. How are you today?
Very good, Peter. Good morning.
Good morning to you. It's actually afternoon here, but good day to you, wherever you may be.
Good day, sir.
Good day to our listeners, wherever they may be. So, Pam, last week we had a great show. We talked a bit about the MBA oath and the Dan Ariely TED Talk, and it was good to see that that got picked up by the people over at the MBA Oath on their blog. They had a post called Morality Reminders Equal Less Cheating, where they referred to our podcast. So that's pretty cool.
Nice.
Yeah, definitely.
It's a good community to be in conversation with, because, you know, that's one of the things I love about working with people who are getting their MBAs. It's a very active time for learning, and then they go out into the world, and you know, those conversations and the learning that they had there really form a big foundation of what they do. So very neat to see Weekly Leader having an impact at that point.
Yeah, we appreciate that they're listening, and we hope they've all subscribed to our listen to all of our future episodes. And anyway, thank you. Hey, Pam, so what's going on out there? You read anything new in the news? Or you got any new projects, exciting projects going on, or attending any events?
Well, on the exciting project front, there's one that I can't really talk about, but it's a merger project and really fun to work on. Continuing executive coaching stuff. It's very neat to see that in this economy that companies are still investing in the executive coaches for their leaders. And I think it's for a couple reasons. One is because those people are now doing a couple different jobs and they need just whatever support, help, guidance that they can have. And so it's fabulous to have that partnership with an executive coach. And the second reason is, I think, while they're asking them to do so darn much for often a cut in pay rather than increase in pay, the last thing they want to do is pull their executive coach out from under them. So on that side, it's going well, and I feel very, very fortunate to be working with the neat quality of people that I'm working with. But there's another thing that I'll mention now that you ask about what's new. There's a tremendous organization that I volunteer with called the Global Women's Leadership Network. And if you're on Twitter, you can find them at Global Wim Lead. That's GlobalWomLead. And I know, Peter, you'll put this on the podcast notes for people to find. It's an organization that I first connected up with them in 2004, just as they were getting started. It's out of Santa Clara University, and the goal really is to bring together emerging women leaders from around the world, many of whom have had no opportunity to be exposed to the sort of leadership programs that you and I have connected with and in a way take for granted, to help them, A, get a network of support, B, you know, learn some things that will be helpful to their leadership, and C, to build contacts and visibility for their organizations. And it has been so much fun over the years to be a part of, a peripheral part, but a part of the tremendous success of the 80 women who've now participated in Women Leaders for the World. And so I'm very excited that the fifth cohort will be held in December, and applications are being accepted right now. And so if you go to the Twitter account for Globe Wim Lead, you'll get the link to go to applications. Women are accepted from the U.S. as well as all around the world. So if you know of someone who is an emerging women leader, and that could be at any age, and they're working in such a diverse set of fields of energy and children's services and environment and all that, feel free to point that person towards this program and help them take their organization to the next level.
Wow, great information. We'll definitely have links to it in the show notes on the blog.
Wonderful. Okay, so where do you want to go with today, Peter?
Well, we got, actually this week, I just thought I'd update people too this week. We're going to get back on course with our CEO interviews, and later on this week I'll be talking with Jay Rogers, who's the CEO of a new car company called Local Motors, and they crowdsource cars. You and your community will design a car on a website, and then you actually go in and build it yourself. They've been getting a ton of coverage recently in Main Street media. And Jay's going to join us and talk to us about leadership. He's a Marine who served in Iraq and now CEO of this company and a Harvard Business School graduate. So an interesting guy. Look forward to talking to him. So we'll have that interview up next week.
Very cool.
So, you know, Sunday mornings, typically I have a chance in the past, at least, to read the New York Times. And I actually used to post interesting articles I thought that were interesting, at least, about leadership. Having two small children, I haven't been able to do that in the last couple of months. But this Sunday, I did. I found a bunch of articles, and they are all posted up on Weekly Leader. But two in particular, I just wanted to throw out there and then tie it all together with another interview we're going to do in the future. On Sunday, two articles that focused on what I thought is President Obama's adaptive leadership style. And the first article was actually in the first section of the newspaper under the politics. And it was the title of it was Hugging Republicans Until It Hurts. And the byline on that was the Obama administration says it's assembling a coalition government that welcomes qualified members of the opposition. It gives the White House a claim to bipartisanship despite continuing clashes with the Republican congressional leaders. But the political benefits are an equally strong incentive. Remaining Republican colleagues become discouraged and feel further isolated in the minority. That was by Carl Holtz. Really what I took away from that article is basically the way he's reached out across the aisle, brought people aboard, the best team players, brought them on board the bus to help solve the problems. Second article was a very much longer article. It appeared in the magazine section, and it was called Taking the Hill. It was about the healthcare battle. And the byline of that is facing a fight on health care and trying to avoid the mistakes of the past. President Obama's team is working Congress from the inside. Both of these articles reminded me of a program that I went to a few years ago at the Harvard Kennedy School. And it was the Art and Practice of Leadership Development. It was 8 days of pretty rigorous program, a very probably one of the most meaningful adult learning experiences I ever had in my life. There were about 65 people, leaders from all over the world, all different sectors, business people, nonprofit leaders, government leaders, who not only were they leaders of their organizations, but many of these people were people who trained leaders. And the program is run by Ron Heifetz and Marty Linsky. And they're two consultants who founded an organization called Cambridge Leadership Associates. And Cambridge Leadership, so in addition to being professors at Harvard, they founded this organization. And CLA focuses a lot on adaptive leadership, basically taking these adaptive challenges, problems that are just so big they are not solved by technical solutions, meaning there's not simple solutions to these problems, and how you approach these major problems. And one of these problems is, you know, our current healthcare system. So in looking at it through that prism, I found these articles pretty interesting, and we'll have links in the show notes to both of them. And I encourage people to read them. But kind of the gist of the adaptive leadership model is, you know, as a leader, you really can't solve the problem yourself. You can't, you know, the days of command and control and giving orders and actually finding solutions to these problems like healthcare and obesity, and as long as you're armed, the list of problems that defy simple solutions, you really have to turn the problem back onto the people at some degree and lead and influence them, have them be part of solving the problem itself. And part of that solution might actually be having people's perceptions about the issues or the problems change itself. So are you familiar with the adaptive leadership model, Pam?
Very, very much so. And I share your admiration for it. And we talked a little bit earlier about MBAs. I think perhaps the most important shift that the MBAs go through in Stanford's first year leadership program is toward that frame that you just described. That leadership is about enabling and supporting people to grapple with the problems rather than solving it for them. And it makes for a very different organization and far more capable teams.
Yeah, and yeah, these articles that I mentioned in the Times, I thought, did a great job of highlighting how Obama's kind of pushing the challenges back towards other people. And you know, a cynic would say he's trying to distance himself from the problem, but my interpretation and my reading is that, you know, he's smart enough to know he can't sit up in the White House and you know, sign orders and give orders and have these problems just be, you know, solved. That in fact, there's lots of different reasons why, but he has to get the and one of the biggest things with the adaptive leadership model, and I think a thing he's doing here is he's transferring ownership of the problem back to some of the people who can actually do some things to solve the problem. So it's going to be interesting to see how this pans out. Healthcare has been a hot issue since the article actually addresses it. You know, remember when the Clintons tried to solve the healthcare issue? Well, times have changed quite a bit, and maybe. That's another thing that you learn when you attend the Art and Practice of Leadership Development, whether a problem is ripe for solving. Back then, the healthcare issue probably wasn't ripe for solving, but today it may be. So maybe taking a slightly different approach and having a set of circumstances that are different may allow us to find some solutions to it. But I found these articles very interesting. Now, our new colleague and contributor, Dr. Ed Brenniger, actually is doing a review of a new book called Adaptive Leadership, which is by, I know it's by Ron Heifetz. I'm not sure if it's co-authored by Marty Linsky or not, but Ed is doing that review currently, and we've been talking with the publisher, and it looks like we've invited, and it looks like it'll happen that we'll have Ron Heifetz or Marty Linsky for the podcast. So we're looking at the week of June 22nd, I think, sometime during that week, and we hope to have them aboard. So we'd probably be posting the interview the week of July 1st, or the first week of July, I should say. So
that's exciting.
Yeah, so it would be very interesting to have them aboard and hear their thoughts and get their read on what's happening, particularly with politics in Washington right now. So last week I threw out an idea that I'd love to spend some time in the future talking about blind spots, and you had a great idea. So want to talk about that a bit?
Sure. And you know, and I think it's a nice segue too from what you were talking about with adaptive leadership, that part of the problem with the old command and control leader decides system is their own blind spots just get writ large upon the organization with very little check. Blind spots have all sorts of powerful and difficult consequences for an organization. So let's talk a little bit about blind spots. And what I thought I'd do is share with you or remind those of you who've been exposed to the Johari window just a little bit about how I'm thinking about blind spots, and then look at it at an organizational level with substantial reference to Jim Collins' new book, How the Mighty Fall, and then look at it at an individual level, and then come back up to the team level. Sound good?
Excellent.
Okay. What do we mean by blind spots? If you will imagine a 2x2, and God help me, ex-Bainey, I can't get through the day without a good 2x2. This is called the Johari window. On one end, one side of it, known to self versus not known to self. And on the vertical dimension, known to others versus not known to others. So you wind up with 4 boxes. One is open. That's information that you know and they know. Then there's hidden, information that you know but other people don't know. Then there's unknown, stuff you don't know and they don't know. And then there's blind spots. And that's things that you don't know, but other people can see. As a leader, what you want to be doing is to have that blind spot box be as small as possible. Because it's a real bummer when you don't know what's going on and other people do. And especially when it's about yourself, your capabilities, your decisions. All right? Just a little note here. There is a really delicious footnote at the bottom of this article by Joseph Luft. It's a long ago article. I don't know if there's a copy online, so I don't know if we'll be able to link to it, but we can certainly put up the Johari window model. It says, the word Johari comes from the names of Joseph Luft and Harry Ingram, Joe and Harry. They called it the Johari window for Joe and Harry, and then later they discovered that it has meanings in Sanskrit and Swahili, and in Sanskrit it means the God who sees within. And in Swahili, it means the essence of things. Really great naming story and a good caution to everyone. They were very fortunate that it turns out that the names were quite positive and relevant. So for those of you who are thinking about combining your names to create some company name or product name or model name, yeah, good to check it out. And now, you know, those tools weren't quite available in the 50s when they coined this. Fortunately, now with the internet, you can check out the the meanings of any product name very quickly. Anyway, on to blind spots. So basically, blind spots are things that you don't know and other people do. And sometimes you don't know them because you don't have a vantage point for seeing them. And sometimes you don't know because you're not looking for them. And sometimes you don't know because basically you've made it clear that you don't want to know. And that ties in so nicely with Jim Collins' tremendous new work. It's called How the Mighty Fall, A Primer on the Warning Signs. And basically, it is set up to address the question of how do you know as a company when you're in decline? Because the seeds of the decline are typically laid before the visible evidence of the decline. So Jim Collins and his colleagues went through their astonishing database of companies and did their methodologies and all that. And I'm going to go through this really quickly, Peter, because I'm sure you can link up to the excellent Business Week article and the Business Week podcast.
Definitely.
And they're, yeah, Jim Collins lays it all out. So I'm just going to give you the roughest of overview and send you to those two resources plus the book, right? But he went through, they went through the research and looked at matching up companies that failed with companies that didn't go all the way into catastrophic failure and looked at what was happening in the companies that led up to the failure. He came up with five stages. Boy, I think this is going to be a really powerful model. Stage one, hubris born of success. And that is when you start to believe that we're successful because we do the things that we do. And you stop looking for information that would contradict what you believe to be true. So that's one of the ways you can create blind spots in the very first stage. The second stage he talks about is the undisciplined pursuit of more. I'm going to skip that right now, but I think it is very worth your study. Stage three, the denial of risk and peril. Stage three is when you say, oh, yeah, well, that negative data, that was just because of that particular thing, or maybe it was calculated wrong, or that was one blip, but we've had all this other success. You amplify the positive, you put the spin on it. And what he talks about that stage in the Business Week article, and what's not in there, but to me is so important, is that when leaders start doing that, Peter, and I'm sure you've seen this a bunch of times, they are sending signals to the rest of the organization, don't send us bad data. Mm-hmm. No, don't send us data that would support good data that supports that things are going badly. You know, often I find that leaders have a blind spot about how amplified their messages are. We talked a little bit about this last week. Somebody throughout the organization reports to the executive team about something, and the executive team looks at the not so good news, and instead of diving in and getting curious and asking questions and wondering what we have to learn, they poo-poo the data. That is sending a very powerful message through the organization that says, we don't want to know. And what happens is that blind spot, the things that they don't know but other people do, gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Stage four, he talks about grasping for salvation. And stage five is when they capitulate to irrelevance or death as a company. Really, really neat model. And I think blind spots play a very critical role in the decline of companies as he lays it out.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you said, individual leaders too, right?
Yeah, let's turn and look to that. And so as people, we've got all sorts of stuff going on with us. One model that I like to work from is Linda Barron's model, and I'll send you a link you can put up on the podcast notes for this. It talks about three sort of rings of ourself. One is our core self, sort of how we popped into the world. And while we pop out uniquely, there are some really good models that help map kind of how our brains are primed to work. I'm a twin sister. My twin and I are very different. We've been different since day one. I have two boys. They're tremendously different. I don't know how different your kids are, but I'm guessing that they popped out with some differences.
Definitely.
You know, we get launched with with some different sort of blueprints. And that's the internal ring, our core personality. And then there's our developed self. And that's really who we are today. We've had a variety of experiences. We've either taken the things that our core likes to do, like solve problems or talk with people or reflect on things on our own or be imaginative or be focused on the facts. Whatever our core self impels us to do, we've either taken those and ran with them and really developed them, or we've had experiences in our life that encourage us to develop some of the other things that maybe were not core to us. Anyway, so we're now these pretty complex folks based on our experiences and our reactions to them. And then there's the contextual self. That's that body of choice that we have. And so the social psychologist will say, well, personality does not explain behavior. It's just one factor. And that's true. And that's fabulous because we're not amoebas, right? We have choices. And people will make contextual choices. So blind spots can happen driven through the core level about where we're sort of primed to look and where we're not primed to look. And they can also happen as a result of our development about things that we've been encouraged to look at. So if we think at the core level, Myers-Briggs, Jungian personality type, one of the best models that I've seen for how to think about that structure of personality, one of the useful things that working with MBTI can do is to help point towards blind spots. And I'm not taking anything away here from strengths. I think it's even more important to know your strengths. However, just as Jim Collins found for those companies, knowing your strengths alone won't save you. You've got to look out for where are the areas that what you're doing doesn't match what the market needs. Or in the case of individuals, where your energy and passion and skills take you isn't quite a great fit for what's needed. So if we take the example of a personality type that's called ENTJ, a very common leadership personality type, one of the blind spots, and here I'm drawing from a new book that's out by one of my dear colleagues, Sharon Lebovitz Richmond, and her book is called Introduction to Type and Leadership, and we'll put up a link for that. She talks about one of the blind spots of ENTJs, and boy, have I seen this again and again, is to believe their own spin about the direction that the organization should go in, leading to ignoring others' views. ENTJs have a lot going for them as leaders, and in fact, tend disproportionately to be leaders. They're about not quite 2% of the population, and about 9% of leaders, and about 12% of executive-level leaders. And yet, there is this blind spot that some are aware of and others not so much, that when it comes to visioning, which is a very internal process for ENTJs, even though they're extroverts, that visioning process tends to be internal. They tend not to articulate how they got there in setting direction, and then it becomes difficult for other people to have the conversation with them. And more often than not, they tend to believe that their internal sense of where to go, of which way is forward, is the right one. And that gets folks into all sorts of hot water. Anyway, all types have blind spots. And working with a coach or trainer or somebody who is very well versed, deeply versed in personality type can help you get a sense for which of the blind spots common to your type are relevant to you. Okay, so that's core. And then there's developed. It's wise, I think, for leaders to step back and reflect on what was the path that got them here and what mentoring they took advantage of. And it may be that you've got mentors who were really terrific about highlighting the data and the analysis and insisting that that all be correct, and maybe were less focused on you building networks across the organization or interacting with others in a way that is encouraging to them. And so it's quite possible that your development has left you with some blind spots and flat sides. I encourage you to think through what was that path for you, which directions were you encouraged in, and what might be some of the things that you pay less attention to. We've looked at organizational, at how the mighty fall, and obviously we did just the quickest skim, so make sure to read the book and listen to the podcast from Business Week. And we've looked at the individual level, both blind spots that can arise out of a core personality and out of your developed self. And then I'd like to complete by looking at the team level. At a team level, you've got a whole bunch of individuals who function either better than or worse than they would alone. And off most teams, there's a mix of both. There are some areas where they function even more effectively and others that are worse. There's a whole stream of research that's been done over the last, mostly the last 10 years, on what are the factors that make diversity, broadly construed, that make diversity a powerful asset for a team or organization, and under what factors is that not the case? Because it's quite clear from the research that more diverse groups tend to either outperform or underperform less diverse groups. So it becomes really quite important, especially now that we're talking about working across functional lines, across geographic lines, across ages, across education levels, as we build that more collaborative, networked, et cetera, organization, that we're increasingly talking about success under conditions of diversity. And here I mean diversity in education, diversity in age, diversity, you know, as well as gender and ethnicity and all of that, because what we're really trying to get to is cognitive diversity. And while core personalities tend to show up in roughly the same percentage around the world, those developed parts of our personality are quite different based on whether you, quote, you know, grew up in marketing or grew up in engineering, whether you grew up in Asia or grew up in South America. So we arrive to our teams now with these really developed selves, and they've developed in different ways. And under what conditions is that diversity going to be really an asset to the organization? And I think more and more this is a critical question. So linking it to blind spots, when we have a team that's not very diverse, the chances for blind spots are incredibly magnified. Mm. I think that's pretty clear. However, when we have a team that's diverse, but they haven't figured out how to make the most of diversity, and it isn't really safe to express everything that you notice and you're capable of seeing, it's as if the diversity isn't there. In fact, it's worse because you're less likely to be engaged. So let me take an example. If you've got a team of people who have, there's folks from headquarters who are, let's also say, let's load it for the social loading factors, they're a little bit older, they're better educated, and then you've got other people on the conference call that are part of this initiative who are from different parts of the world, maybe different ethnicities, maybe women, if that's a rarity in the organization, et cetera, et cetera. If the folks who, in this example, are from headquarters, don't make a real effort to reach out and listen and to encourage people to engage and to actually, unlike Bob Phelps, who we were talking about with the New York Times last week, not lose the notes, follow up on their important points, and show their people that they're listening to people throughout the organization, unless the leaders with the powerful loading make that effort, it's quite easy not to get the benefits of diversity and actually to have the experience be more distancing for the people who were supposed, who you appointed to the committee to bring cognitive and geographical and all that diversity. You can wind up with blind spots either because you don't have a very diverse team or you haven't created the conditions under which diversity and also differences of opinion can really flourish. And there's an example that I wanted to share with you, Peter, and to share with our listeners that I think brings this home. I was asked to work several years ago, actually with Sharon Richmond, who wrote Introduction to Type and Leadership, to support an executive education program at Stanford that was a customized program for 30 top leaders of a very large company around the world. And they brought these folks to Stanford. And the focus was on change leadership because they were leading this enormous change of this organization. The CEO and the next couple people weren't there, but it was that next body of executives from around the world. And there was quite a lot of concern about whether the change would succeed. We asked them a question that some people who really love positive framing will not like, but I think it was right for the group at the time. And that question was, if this big change effort fails, why will it have failed? And we framed it for them like this. The CEO has called you in 18 months from now and said, damn it, this thing failed. What happened? Why did it fail? And so we asked the 30 executives who are participating to jot down some bullet points that they would use for that conversation with the CEO. And then we organized the bullet points by temperament, which is one lens on personality type that links to Myers-Briggs. And this was a group that was very fluent in Myers-Briggs Jungian typology, and they enjoyed using it, found it very useful. So we organized it up by the four categories of temperament, and it was astonishing how similar the points were. So the stabilizers, if you know Myers-Briggs, might be called the SJs, said, well, this change effort failed because we did not get down to the tactical level of new processes. We didn't give people clear roles and responsibilities. We didn't button this thing down, and chaos ensued. The SP improvisers said, this thing will fail because we don't spend enough time on actually doing the work and negotiating in the moment and making change. We're too busy creating policy manuals and roles and responsibilities and all of that, and we didn't actually go forth and seize opportunities. And the NT theorists said, we did not have enough of a systems perspective. We changed one thing over here and another thing over here, and we didn't have an overarching structure for this. We also didn't align our various groups and tactics with the overall strategy. And the one lone NF catalyst in the group said, we forgot about the people. We treated them as cogs in the wheel, and we forgot to focus on getting them engaged in actually delivering on this change. And Peter, it was a really astonishing moment when we put that up in front of people, and there was just this hushed silence. And we said, okay, what on here isn't important? What would we take down? And they said, oh my gosh, we have to get all of this right. Wow. Most of the things that were on the charts that didn't represent their own personality type were things that they weren't focused on. And they had high potential to become blind spots for those leaders in the room. And so it really just struck home for me about the importance of knowing what your own blind spots are, engaging other people to help you remember, oh yeah, I forget to focus on this. I better focus on this so that we can get the whole puzzle right.
Interesting. And how'd they do?
Well, the company still exists. They went through a tough time, but they definitely pulled it through and out and forward. They accomplished what they set out to do.
Great. We will definitely have a link to the article, and there's lots of good sidebar information in the article that appeared in Business Week. So we definitely encourage you to read that, as well as the podcast. It's we've mentioned the podcast before. It's a cover story podcast. It's done by John Byrne every issue. And this one's a little longer than normal, and it's an interview actually with Jim Collins. So highly encourage you to listen to that too, because he's a great storyteller. Yeah, good stuff. A couple of things in the article that really jumped out at me. First of all, he makes a point of saying that, you know, you get to yourself to stage five and you're cooked. You're done. You're dead, yeah. Dead duck. But along the way, early on, it's very tough to see this stage as a decline, but easy to fix them. But as you move along the chart, as you progress along the five stages, they become easier to identify and then more difficult to solve. So we should keep that in mind as we look at this model. Also that, their research indicated that the organizational decline is largely self-inflicted and recovery is largely within our own control. And I think that's probably true for individuals too, don't you think, Pam?
The sort of processes that we're talking about here, that you really can do very specific practices as a leader that will reduce the size of your blind spot. And it's up to you to do it. People are not going to remind you, hey, how's that blind spot quadrant going? Anything I can do to help reduce that and make things more visible to you? No, you've got to take it upon yourself as a leader and do some really basic but sometimes seems hard to do things, which is to ask, what am I missing? Not that you're not clear and confident and all that, but to combine that clarity that you bring as a leader and saying, this is what I believe and here's how I got there and all of that, with taking that extra step to say, I'm probably missing something here. What do you see that I'm missing? What do you see that I'm missing? Where could we be going wrong on this? And as Jim Collins referenced, only the paranoid survive. The famous line from
Andy Grove.
Yeah. And, you know, we had a saying it being that there's always a problem with the client relationship. You just don't know what it is. And it kept us very focused on asking the questions that will keep our blind spot pretty small.
One of the other things, stage one hubris of success, you did a great job of going over that. One of the things that stuck with me too in reading and listening to the podcast was the idea of luck involved in success. And he laid out basically the dangers of feeling you're totally responsible for your own success. And in fact, those that are the best leaders, I think they identified, are ones that can't attribute the success to specific factors and also actually acknowledge that they've been pretty lucky. And so I think it's important from what it says about the person and the perspective the person has, I think, than anything else. And then, finally, you also touched on denial of risk and peril. And my only point I'd like to make with that is, if you're listening to this right now or you read the book and you say, well, I don't suffer from that, you probably do. You know, we all do to some degree, and that's probably one of the toughest things to overcome. So if you keep anywhere an open mind about things, you should keep it there. We've talked about this before, confirmation bias, discounting negative data. You know, there's all kinds of tricks we play on ourselves about strengthening our own position. We have to be so absolutely careful about, I believe. The article also had a great sidebar, what they learned on the way down. And it was two senior executives reflect on the lessons they learned in managing companies that were losing ground and struggling through tough times. And one of the executives was Daniel Mudd. He was the CEO of Fannie Mae. The only reason I bring it to your attention is, you know, obviously Fannie Mae's been in the news quite a bit lately, but I found it really interesting in the sidebar of how he talks about or writes about his experiences on the way down. And he doesn't seem to blame anybody in any way. This is something I've actually been creating a post about for Weekly Leader, is Fannie Mae seemed to have been caught a little bit in a, and Daniel Mudd in particular as a CEO seemed to be caught in between a rock and a hard place with respect to the pressure from Congress to make lending policies that gave every American the opportunity to own a home, and balance that against the fact that every American probably can't afford or have the resources or the capabilities and for whatever reason to afford or can pay for a home. And it just seemed like this was one of the leadership dilemmas you can find yourselves in occasionally. So in reading the article, I just thought it was very interesting that in no way did he kind of blame anybody else for the challenges that he faced.
Such a great point, Peter. And maybe that sows the seeds for another topic for a podcast, which is about managing paradox. And sometimes what leaders get into is to try to have less cognitive dissonance and try to have less of the stress of paradox and just come down on one side versus the other. But what can often be more useful, although it requires a big grown-up brain, is to be able to hold them both and still make good decisions. And that brings us right back to where we started with Heifetz.
So Pam, anything else you want to talk about with Jim Collins' book or blind spots or anything else?
That's it.
So great analysis, Pam, as usual. And hopefully our listeners will take away some good learnings about blind spots. Can't eliminate them, I don't think, but you can certainly be aware of them and try to minimize them. Hopefully we've done that a bit. We would love to have you join us in the leadership conversation. So hop on over to weeklyleader.net and find one of the podcast posts and give us some feedback about what you hear here or what you'd like to hear in the future. There's some really super content over there. Our bloggers are passionate about leadership, and they'd love to join in the leadership conversation with you as well. So feel free to comment on any one of their posts. You can send us an email at podcast@weeklyleader.net. And if you wanted to attach a small audio file of 5 megs or less, we would find a way to integrate it into the show, because your voice would be a welcome addition to Pam and mine. All of us are on Twitter. Weekly Leader has an ID. It's Weekly Leader. Pam's at PamFR, and I'm at Peter Mello. That's PeterMello. All of our contributors are there, and their Twitter IDs will be in the show notes as well. We've asked you the last couple of weeks to go to iTunes if you use that service and to rate and review the podcast, and we would really appreciate that as well. Every week we play PodSafe music for you, and it usually comes from the PodSafe Music Network. The intro music is Transcends by Trance Blackman. And this week we have a song by the band Seabird, and it's Sometimes. So thank you for investing your time with us, and we look forward to being with you again next week.
Still love you if you do.